look today at the gospel's influence in Ephesus, and we'll be finishing the 19th chapter today. Next 2 weeks, anyway, I want to spend in chapter 20. I don't know if we'll go beyond two sermons, maybe three. Wonderful sermon, in a sense, that Paul spoke to the elders of Miletus in chapter 20. I thought that would be a good place, maybe, that we'll step away from our study of Acts. We've been in this book for well over a year now, and look at some other things. So certainly, I'm going to spend some time in the book of Romans with you, too, looking forward to that. But in our last sermon, we saw that through Paul's ministry, teaching daily in the Hall of Tyrannus, the gospel was heard throughout Asia Minor. Let's look at that for just a moment. If you look here in chapter 19, I want to read verses 9 and 10. Paul speaking of the opposition he met at the synagogue, he says, "But when some became stubborn and continued in unbelief, speaking evil of the way before the congregation, he withdrew from them and took the disciples with him, reasoning daily in the hall of Tyrannus. This continued for 2 years, so that all the residents of Asia heard the word of the Lord, both Jews and Greeks." And that's quite interesting here what Paul did, because he reasoned daily in this facility that was available unto him, at least for part of the day. This means he really probably did some in-depth teaching, having opportunity to minister to people for quite an extended time there. And when it says all the residents of Asia heard the word of the Lord, both Jews and Greeks, I don't think it's because they all came down there to Ephesus to hear him. I think it's likely it's because he sent people out from that sort of a teaching academy, if you will, that perhaps this was. And they took the gospel out there to these many, many residents in Asia, and thus this worked to the spreading of the gospel. When you think of the letters to the churches, the seven churches of Revelation, they're all there. They're all in this area close to Ephesus, and likely may have even been formed through this ministry, at least greatly helped, if not actually formed. So, today's passage indicates that the truth, the gospel, was having an impact on the whole city of Ephesus. Idolatry and occultism, so strong there, were losing their grip on the local citizens. And a man named Demetrius, a prominent silversmith, stirred up people so that a riot ensued to try to oppose Paul's preaching. This passage that we're looking at gives us reason to reflect not only on the gospel's power to save the elect people of God from sin, but to have a certain transforming effect on others as well. The gospel doesn't always bring all persons to salvation, but there's a transforming effect that the gospel can have on others who are not included in the household of faith. This has happened before. It happened in Ephesus. We're going to see some of the reasoning to that. It happened before in North America. It happened in the colonies during the Great Awakening in the 1740s, where I'm not an expert on the Great Awakening at all, but we read about how entire villages were impacted with a more God-centered way of living. People who were drunk most of the time stopped drinking. Many things of that were the impact that particular time in church history had upon a great many people. Could that happen again? Could that happen in our day? Could that happen here in the communities we live in? Something to think about as we look at this passage. Now, first of all, we want to note that Paul is thinking of some plans now that actually go beyond Ephesus. If you'll look here at verse 21, And actually, this church now becomes the city, and the church that developed there becomes the people he stayed more longer with than any other group. He stayed a long time in Corinth. According to a verse that's in chapter 20, he actually was here in Ephesus for 3 years. This is a long time for a church planter to stay in one place, but he did stay for a long time. Verse 21, it says, now after these events, and we could ask what events. Well, remember, we just read last time then about how the Christians had come to realize that they couldn't stay into things dabbling in the occultism. Many of them had at one time, and they realized they can't do this anymore. They came, confessed that they had been involved in that sort of thing. They burned their books. Tremendous amount of wealth went up in these books that had incantations and such. And that in itself shows the remarkable effect the gospel is having on the city. Not just the Christians, but others are seeing this happen. So after these events here in verse 21, Paul resolved in his spirit to pass through Macedonia and Achaia and go to Jerusalem, saying, after I've been there, I must also see Rome. And having sent into Macedonia two of his helpers, Timothy and Erastus, he himself stayed in Asia, or in other words, in Ephesus, for a while. Here we have mention of Timothy and Erastus. When Paul started out on this third journey, nobody was mentioned as with him, but we see that there were others with him. And in fact, when we get into chapter 20, we're going to see a great number of people who are kind of gathered around Paul, first maybe to protect him because some plots are made against him and some other things too. So we read here that he wanted to pass through Macedonia. So he went back to Philippi. He's gone over to Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea. These would be the three cities he ministered in Macedonia. Then he went down into Achaia. That would be Corinth. I'm guessing he probably bypassed Athens. He had not been received well there. But so he comes down to Achaia. And then he wanted to go on to Jerusalem. And that didn't work out that way right now. As we'll see later on, a plot was made against him. But he wanted to go to Jerusalem. It seemed he would have planned to just sail from Corinth to Jerusalem. And that had to change his plans on that, as we will see next week. And he said, I must also see Rome. Which is rather interesting, too, because Paul's method was always to go where nobody else had been. He wanted to break new ground. He wanted to start churches where there was no gospel yet. But in this case, he wanted to go to Rome, where there is an established church. But he definitely wanted to go there. He did go there. But again, God has a way of changing our plans. He went there as a prisoner, but he had a very effective ministry when he got to Rome. And part of that is he wrote four of the epistles that are included in the New Testament when he was there. So we want to consider that here, that Paul's ministry is not only affecting believers, but others also. The believers are burning their occult books. They realize they can't stay in that sort of thing if they're true followers of Jesus. And others are watching and are impacted. So now we want to look at this passage in which I'd call him very clever. This man, Demetrius, who is a silversmith, and he's going to oppose the teaching of Paul. I want to read the rest of the chapter here now, beginning in verse 23, to the end. And Demetrius really knows how to stir people up and get them excited and get them angry. He's going to say two things. There's two things this Apostle Paul is doing. He's ruining our business. selling, making and selling these silver idols, and we have a great deal of civic pride here in our city because we are the city that has this great temple to Artemis, and Paul's just causing people to have little interest in our goddess here. And he really stirs them up. Let's read about it here. Verse 23, about that time there arose no little disturbance concerning the way. For a man named Demetrius, a silversmith who made silver shrines of Artemis, brought no little business to the craftsmen. These he gathered together with the workmen in similar trades and said, men, you know that from this business we have our wealth. And you see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a great many people, saying that gods made with hands are not gods. And there is a danger not only that this trade of ours may come into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis may be counted as nothing, and that she may even be deposed from her magnificence, she whom all Asia and the world worship. When they heard this, they were enraged and were crying out, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. So the city was filled with the confusion, and they rushed together into the theater. And this theater was huge, an amphitheater that would hold 25,000 people. Dragging with them Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians, who were Paul's companions in travel. So we see here's two other people who were actually with Paul at this time. But when Paul wished to go in among the crowd, the disciples would not let him. And even some of the Asiarchs, who were friends of his, sent to him and were urging him not to venture into the theater. Now some cried out one thing, some another, for the assembly was in confusion, and most of them did not know why they had come together. Some of the crowd prompted Alexander, whom the Jews had put forward, and Alexander, motioning with his hand, wanted to make a defense to the crowd. But when they recognized that he was a Jew, for about 2 hours, they all cried out with one voice, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. And this is what can happen with a mob, where just this frenzy overtakes for a time. Then we see what happened in verse 35. And when the town clerk had quieted the crowd, he said, men of Ephesus, who is there who does not know that the city of the Ephesians is temple keeper of the great Artemis and of the sacred stone that fell from the sky? Seeing then that these things cannot be denied, you ought to be quiet and do nothing rash, for you have brought these men here who are neither sacrilegious nor blasphemers of our goddess. If therefore Demetrius and the craftsmen with him have a complaint against anyone, the courts are open and there are proconsuls. Let them bring charges against one another. But if you seek anything further, it shall be settled in the regular assembly, for we really are in danger of being charged with rioting today, since there is no cause that we can give to justify this commotion. And when he had said these things, he dismissed the assembly. I think it's interesting, too, here how God brought about a deliverance for Paul. Remember back in Corinth, when Paul was brought before the proconsul Gaius and accusations were going to be made against him by the Jews. It says when he was just about ready to open his mouth, well, Gaius intervened and said he wasn't going to have anything to do with this. And here again, Paul wanted to go into this theater. It's hard to say what they might have done to him if he had. But the town clerk comes forward, just the providence of God stepping in at just the right time to avoid something undesirable happening here. But let's get back to the man Demetrius and how he stirred all these people up. He basically said, our economy is being ruined by this Paul. Our economy depends upon these silver shrines of Artemis, as he called it, these idols they were making. And people came from all over the world to the city of Ephesus. One of the reasons they came, well, it was because of this temple to Artemis, which was more than just a temple to the goddess. It was a bank. I read about that people from all over the world did their banking by coming to this central place. And And these, there must have been a great amount of worship of this goddess Artemis, because people came here, they bought these little shrines or big shrines or idols that were made, and there would have been a very much a trickle-down effect here when there is a business that you have to have lodging, you have to have food. And so that's the first thing he says. He's got everybody stirred up that this is going to affect the economy of Ephesus. It's this Paul who's done this. The second thing that he brings up here is something the people of Ephesus, I think, were quite proud about, that this temple existed in their city, and this was their claim to fame, that the temple of Artemis is here. Look at verse 27 again, what he says about this. And there's danger not only that this trade of ours may come into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis may be counted as nothing, and that she may even be deposed from her magnificence, she whom all Asia and the world worship. So people are losing interest in coming here to see the goddess in the temple and to see this great building here. I read, there's a note right here in the Reformation Study Bible. It says about this temple, the archaic Ionic temple of Artemis measured 220 by 425 feet with 127 marble columns, each 62 feet high. The lowest drums of the 36 western columns were carved with reliefs. And people are going to stop coming here to see this great temple. I'm not real good at illustrations, but so I thought I'd come up with one here, that if you took the cheese factory out of Tillamook, what would Tillamook have to be proud of? That's not a very great illustration, but I'll never be noted for my great illustration. But it's that sort of thing. This is what this city's famous for, and for the banking that goes on there. So Demetrius has painted a very bleak picture. Thought I'd just mention a little bit about this temple. It was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, one of the largest buildings in the world at that time, four times larger than the Parthenon. And as best I could figure out from what I read, there was a statue of the goddess in the temple. And sometimes Derek Thomas says they would take it out once a year and they'd take it around town and people would give offerings to it. But there was something else too. There was this, look at verse 35, what the town clerk said. Ephesians is the temple keeper of the great Artemis, the sacred stone that fell from the sky. There was something that had fallen out of the sky, probably part of a meteorite, and this was a most strange object. It was said that it looked like an object covered with many breasts of a woman. And somehow this too was revered. And I was reading some things from F.F. Bruce particularly, that along with this there was nature worship, and the breasts on this object embodied the nourishing capacity of nature. So that got me to thinking, does this have anything to do with Mother Nature? Well, maybe not. I don't know. But it always bothers me when people talk about Mother Nature. I mean, who is Mother Nature? Mother Nature did this with the weather. Mother Nature did this with the weather. Mother Nature is nothing. There isn't any Mother Nature. It's God who acts. It's God who does these things. And God acts in what we call the laws of nature, which are just really His ordinary acts of providence that He does. I mean, our destinies aren't in control of Mother Nature. God controls the weather and all other things too. So that's just kind of a pet peeve I have, that once in a while I have to take a sort of a smack at Mother Nature. Doesn't this sort of sound silly to you, this matter of worshiping these idols and making so much of this idol temple? Let's look at something in Isaiah chapter 44, where Isaiah speaks of idolatry and the ignorance that goes along with it. And yet many people who got involved in idolatry were highly intelligent people, except when it comes to things like this. Notice what Isaiah writes about the foolishness of making idols and falling down and worshiping idols. Pick it up here in Isaiah 44, verse 12. The ironsmith makes a cutting tool and cuts it and works it over the coals. He fashions it with hammers and works it with his strong arm. He becomes hungry and his strength fails. He drinks no water and is faint. The carpenter stretches a line. He marks it out with a pencil. He shapes it with planes and marks it with a compass. He shapes it into the figure of a man, with the beauty of a man to dwell in a house. He cuts down cedars, or he chooses a cypress tree or an oak and lets it grow strong among the trees of the forest. He plants a cedar and the rain nourishes it. Then it becomes fuel for a man. He takes a part of it and warms himself. He kindles a fire and bakes bread. Also, he makes a god and worships it. He makes an idol and falls down before of it. Half of it he burns in the fire. Over the half he eats meat. He roasts it and is satisfied. Also, he warms himself and says, "Aha, I am warm. I have seen the fire." And the rest of it he makes into a god, his idol, and falls down to it and worships it. He prays to it and says, "Deliver me, for you are my God." They know not, nor do they discern, for he has shut their eyes so that they cannot see, and their heart so that they cannot understand. No one considers, nor is there knowledge or discernment to say, "Half of it I burned in the fire. I also baked bread on its coals. I roasted meat and have eaten. And shall I make the rest of it an abomination? Shall I fall down before a block of wood?" He feeds on ashes. A deluded heart has led him astray, and he cannot deliver himself or say, "Is there not a lie in my right hand?" And that's Isaiah's commentary on idolatry. This was written 150 years before the Babylonian captivity. It's interesting that the Babylonian captivity cured Israel of idol worship. They no longer worshiped idols when they came back to the land. They had many other faults, but not that particular one. And yet the majority of the nations continued in idolatry. And we won't look at this, but you can look at it for yourself, that in 1 Corinthians 10, the significant statement there in 1 Corinthians 10, verses 19 to 22, that Paul makes it clear that behind the worship of idols is the work of demons, have promoted this sort of thing. And that makes it, of course, all the more dangerous, is that idolatry is a functioning of the demonic world promoting it. Of course, we're far too sophisticated to fall for any of this stuff. However, Colossians 3, verse 5 speaks of covetousness, which is idolatry. So the devil's still working to stir up things in people's lives and, in fact, in our culture as well. We have to be aware of these kinds of idolatry as well. So what I want us to see here, however, is that the reason this is happening in Ephesus and Demetrius is bringing this opposition is because the gospel is succeeding. The gospel is working in people's lives, not just the believers, but the whole city's being affected. People are losing interest in buying these little idols, or big idols, whichever they were. Some were big, some were small. And the temple, Artemis, is getting a lot less attention from everybody. And that's the impact that the gospel can have, and that is such a good thing when that happens. So let's make some application of that for today. Wouldn't we like to see that happen today? That the gospel, which has obviously impacted our lives, would have another impact on others as well. And it would have to be through the church. And that's how the gospel can impact society, is through the church, through your lives. The fact that you know Christ and that transforms your lives, people see that. And it impacts them too. Turn to Ephesians chapter 5. And I would have you take note that this is all happening in Ephesus. And here Paul's writing to the church in that city in this letter. Let me just pick it up here in verse 8. Ephesians 5 verse 8. He's writing to the believers now. He says, "For at one time you were darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light, for the fruit of light is found in all that is good and right and true. And try to discern what is pleasing to the Lord." Then he says, "Take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them. For it is shameful even to speak of the things that they do in secret. But when anything is exposed by the light, it becomes visible. For anything that becomes visible is light. Therefore it says, 'Awake, O sleeper, and arise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you.' Look carefully then how you walk, not as unwise but as wise, making the best use of the time because the days are evil." And of course, when Paul talks about how you walk, he's talking about how you live. And go back to verse 11. "Take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but expose them." And the presence of the church is meant to expose the darkness. The light shining exposes the darkness, even often without saying anything. Just the different lifestyle of a Christian compared to a non-Christian, this can have an impact. Indeed, it does have an impact on other people's lives. You affect other people by being here and living a Christian lifestyle. And we're called to do that. Let me just kind of give an illustration, if you allow me to do that again. Let's just imagine you have neighbors and they watch you leave home every Sunday morning, week after week, month after month, and they say, "Where are those people going? There's no toys being hauled behind the car. There's no camping equipment that I can see. No skis on the top of the car. And they're always carrying a book out into their car." Well, of course, they know where you're going. They know you're going to church. And that's a tremendous witness to them. And perhaps, just perhaps, when those neighbors, someday when their world is collapsing all around them, they're going to come to you. They're going to come to you because they might think that there's something that you know that can help. When they come and they say, "I have cancer. I'm terminal. My doctor says, what's going to become of me?" And let me say, that's why you're here. That's why God hasn't taken you home to heaven yet. Well, there's some other reasons, such as the fact that He wants to work in your sanctification further. But one of the main reasons we are here is to show the light of Jesus Christ to others. Turn to 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2, look at verses 9 and 10. There's a lot of passages that I realize we turn to many, many times. I just think they're so relevant to our subjects and to our life. And this is one of them where Peter speaks about the church. He says in verse 9, "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Do you see why you're here? Why you're here, excuse me? You see why you are still remain here? It's that you may proclaim the excellencies of God, that you may proclaim the excellencies of Christ, that you may proclaim through the life you live, there is a proclamation in your lifestyle, and beyond that, the very gospel message itself, which they must hear. People must hear the gospel. Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of Christ. And that's a good purpose. That's a real reason for being here. Turn to chapter 3, verse 15, same book here, where Peter also writes, "But in your hearts regard Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and respect, having a good conscience, so that when you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame." So again, purpose here that we have to be the light of the world, to let our light shine. And that's what happened in Ephesus, and that's why the whole riot occurred, because somebody opposed that. But it was happening. Lives were being changed. The gospel does bring opposition, but this is a good thing. And it happened in the Great Awakening. It can happen here, too. It can happen in your neighborhood. It can happen with somebody you know, that as you bear that witness to them, it may well lead to a transformation in their life and perhaps an opening to the gospel itself. So we'll stop there today, and I encourage you to read on with the 20th chapter. We still have some very good things to look at before we conclude our study of Acts.